After the debacle that was their raid on the safe house in Norwalk, the Echo Command unit returned to the Ravensgate Commandery and debriefed. Riley passed on word about the theft to the facilities commander and was told the safe house would be cleaned, restocked, and the alarm systems given an upgrade. He spent some time cleaning and storing his gear and was on his way to his office to write up his after-action report when Hennessy intercepted him in the hallway to let him know the Preceptor expected him in his office immediately.
I found him, sir.
You wanted to see me, Preceptor?
What the hell are you doing out there, Captain?
Riley wondered if their raid that afternoon had been caught on videotape or something. He couldn't think of anything else that would set the Preceptor off in this fashion.
I told you to track down Commander Williams and bring him in for questioning. Why the hell hasn't that happened yet?
We've been having difficulty locating Commander Williams.
You don't know where he is?
No, sir, I don't.
Really? Not even a little clue?
No, sir.
Well, then I'll tell you where that son of a bitch is, Captain. He's right here in your own backyard. While you were out gallivanting around chasing ghosts, he was breaking into the reliquary and stealing another precious artifact.
The Preceptor stormed over to his desk and snatched up the remote. He pointed it at the flat screen on the wall across from his desk and stabbed at the power button. The screen flared to life, showing what looked to Riley to be a surveillance video of some kind. The image was black and white and had that strange, stretched look that you get from shooting through a wide-angle lens like those they use to cover as much distance and angle as possible. This particular video was aimed at a particular door at the end of a long corridor. Because he'd been there before, to witness the death of this man's predecessor, no less, Riley recognized it as the corridor outside the reliquary at the Commandery in Rhode Island.
Oh, shit.
A man entered the video frame from the section of the hallway not covered by the camera. He was dressed in dark clothing. Black, maybe dark blue. It was hard to tell, given that it was black and white video. And he carried a pistol in his right hand. He walked directly to the end of the hall and stopped in front of the security devices controlling entrance to the reliquary, in this case a palm scanner and a card reader. He stashed the gun in the small of his back for a moment, dug a key card out of his pocket, and swiped it through the reader. The light on the reader changed, no doubt from red to green, indicating the card had been accepted. The intruder then pressed one hand against the scanner while he did something to the number pad with the other one. To Riley's surprise, the door clicked open. Still, Riley didn't see how any of this involved Cade. The intruder in the video might be him, it might not. It was awfully hard to tell when all you could see was the back of the man's head. The man in the video could be anyone. He could name half a dozen people who fit the general description without trying. For all Riley knew, it could be one of the Necromancer's cronies. Hell, it could be the Necromancer himself. After all, Logan and Williams were of the same general height and build. The Necromancer had managed to infiltrate their defenses once before, and it seemed likely that he could have figured out a way to do so again. Riley was about to say as much to Johansson when the man in the video did a strange thing. As he reached out to push open the door to the reliquary, the intruder turned and looked back in the direction of the camera. The angle wasn't perfect, and the image was degraded a little bit by the lighting in the hallway. But that didn't matter too much. There was no mistaking that the man in the video was Cade.
There! Right there! Do you see that cocky son of a bitch? He's doing it on purpose, daring us to try and stop him.
I'm not sure
that's what... You're not sure? Of course you're not sure. You haven't been sure of a single damned thing since I put you in charge of this investigation. I'll tell you what you can be sure of. This bastard is finished.
Johansson turned to his assistant.
I want arrest orders issued for Williams immediately. If he so much as lifts a finger towards another Templar, they are free to use deadly force to be certain that he doesn't escape again.
On what grounds?
Aiding and abetting the enemy. Otherwise, known as treason.
The object of Riley's concern was at that moment less than 20 miles away, standing in an all but empty bus station and staring at the row of lockers in front of him. He was still dressed like a priest, but he had left the sword and gun behind in the rental car. Cade was holding the 4,000-year-old staff of a long-dead court magician in one hand. He could feel the powers radiating from the staff like the touch of some foul creature on his skin and wanted nothing more than to be rid of it, but he was struggling with the implications of letting it out of his sight. In the Egyptian pantheon, Anubis had been the jackal-headed funerary god, the guardian and protector of the dead. He held the scales of judgment and determined the fate of the soul as it sought access to the afterlife. Unsurprisingly, the staff's primary use was as a tool for controlling the dead, and by turning it over to the necromancer, Cade knew that he would be increasing his enemy's strength and abilities tenfold. On the other hand, he really didn't see what choice he had. He'd been surprised to find only two guards on duty when he'd entered the reliquary. He'd been able to subdue one of them before they were aware of his presence, and had held the other at gunpoint while making him handcuff himself to a nearby equipment console. After that, it had been a simple matter to access the inventory on the guard's computer, determine what case the staff of Anubis had been stored in, and take it into his custody. All that was left at that point was to figure out a way out of the complex before the guards were discovered, and a nearby fire alarm had taken care of that issue quite nicely. In the subsequent confusion, he had made his way back to the parking garage, stolen a Suburban from the motor pool, and driven out of the commandery with no one the wiser. He made the necessary call in regard to turning over the staff to Simon Logan and received instructions by text 10 minutes later, telling him to take the staff to the bus station and leave it in the locker. Which was all well and good, until Cade realized that he hadn't been told which locker and was then unable to reach Logan a second time to ask. Now he was standing in the dimly lit station just after 11 p.m., staring at row after row of storage lockers and wondering just which one was the right one. Figuring the necromancer must have marked the locker in some way that he'd be able to recognize, Cade triggered his sight. The version of the bus station that existed in the beyond was nearly swallowed in a thick miasma of loneliness, fear, and pain, of dreams broken and crushed beneath the heel of the harsh reality of life that threatened to overwhelm Cade's senses and send him wandering the real world in a fit of debilitating depression. He fought against it, refusing to fall back into the self-destruction and self-loathing that he had first experienced after his wife's tragic passing, and after a moment was able to reject the dismal atmosphere of the beyond for the alien thing it was. With the emotional influence of the beyond now under his control, he was able to look around at the bus station's darker half, and suddenly he had his answer. One of the lockers stood out from the rest, marked as it was with a glowing red pentacle or upward-facing five-pointed star that was a common symbol of the black arts. Noting its position, Cade canceled his sight. Keeping his gaze on the locker so he wouldn't lose track of which one it was, he walked over and opened it up. Taped to the back of the locker was an envelope with his name written on it in a spidery hand. Cade pulled the envelope free and tore it open. Inside was a note.
Leave the staff inside the locker and secure it behind you. Wait for new instructions.
Cade did as he was told. Riley paced back and forth in the narrow confines of his office, trying to keep from losing his cool. He was absolutely furious and had to resist the urge to smash his desk chair against the wall or he'd have nothing to sit on. That arrogant fool of a preceptor was about to start a war with the wrong individual. Cade would eat him alive and then come back for seconds, and they'd still be no closer to finding the necromancer than they were right now.
This is insane!
Riley knew he had to do everything in his power to extricate the order from the situation before things totally went to hell. He had to find Cade before anyone else did. But how?
Work the evidence.
It was there, somewhere, the piece of the puzzle he needed to blow this thing wide open, and he just wasn't seeing it yet.
Put the case together piece by piece.
He was certain to see what he had overlooked. He'd gotten more information out of the Preceptor before he'd stalked out. Apparently, Cade had lured 4th Squad's commander, Sergeant Lyons, off the grounds to a meeting outside a local restaurant where he had somehow convinced Lyons to take him back to the commandery and get him through security at the gate without anyone recognizing who he was. That suggested he'd been wearing a disguise of some kind, which in turn explained the outfit Cade had been wearing in the surveillance video. Cade was a hiking boots, blue jeans, and t-shirt kind of guy, and the outfit he'd had on had looked more like a clerk or custodian's uniform. Lyons had been injected with a combination of drugs Riley recognized as being standard issue for interrogation purposes and had been left to sleep it off in an empty office down the hall from the reliquary. Aside from the injury to his pride, Lyons was unharmed. Hopefully, he could confirm some of their assumption when he woke up from his chemically induced nap. After bypassing security, Cade had overpowered the two men working inside the reliquary and had stolen a single item, the staff of Anubis. He had then returned to ground level of the commandery and had pulled the nearest fire alarm, slipping outside with the crowd without being recognized. It had been a simple yet elegant plan, and it had been executed with precision. Typical Cade, in other words. It seemed clear to Riley that Cade was intentionally trying to keep from injuring those he encountered. Cade had warned him off. Lyons had been drugged. The guards in the reliquary had been knocked unconscious. With the exception of Brother Samuel at the French monastery, and Riley was convinced the seriousness of that injury had been entirely accidental, no one had come to any serious harm. It was a marked contrast to the trail of bodies the necromancer would have left in his wake, and Riley, for one, was glad that it was Cade who was collecting the artifacts and not Logan. That line of thought brought Riley to the relics themselves. The hand of a Christian saint and a staff that legend said was connected to the Egyptian deity Anubis. At first glance, they didn't seem to have anything in common. But upon closer examination into the background of each item, it was clear that both had been used not only to interact with the dead, but also to bring the dead back to life. Logan's power was already considerable, he knew. Riley had seen firsthand the kind of forces that Logan could raise to do his bidding, from revenants to corpse hounds to demons from the very plains of hell itself. He could call the dead to get up and walk again anytime he liked.
What good would the hand or the staff do him?
That was the question of the hour. Logan had gone after the items almost immediately after escaping from Templar custody. That showed he'd been thinking about the process for some time and that it wasn't pure happenstance. He not only wanted them, but he needed them for something. But what?
Maybe they're a focus, a way of taking the necromancer's powers and boosting them beyond his current abilities, like an amplifier of some kind.
The idea was a reasonable one, and Riley decided to run with it, see where it took him.
Okay, if the relics are intended to boost his abilities, to give him more power, then what does he need that power for?
His brow furrowed.
Or more specifically, what is he trying to raise that requires that much power?
The answer, when it came to him, sent a chill up his spine. New instructions reached Cade before he was even out of the parking lot. He dug the phone out of his pocket and looked at the screen.
One more item, and your precious Gabrielle can go free. Bring me the feather of an archangel. I believe you already have one in your possession.
Cade stared at the tiny message and suddenly understood, beyond the shadow of a doubt, just what it was that the necromancer intended to do. He'd suspected it when the first request had come to him, had that suspicion grow into belief after retrieving the staff, and now there seemed to be little doubt that he was correct. The message confirmed it. It also told him something else. Logan wanted him to know what he was up to. It was right there, in between the lines of his latest message, a gauntlet thrown down to see if Cade was up to the challenge, daring him to try to stop what was about to happen. Cade felt his blood start to boil at the thought. There was no way he could walk away now. The two of them had been on a collision course since the day this had all begun many years before. Two moons orbiting a dark star on intersecting trajectories that would one day eventually bring them slamming into each other at incredible speeds. That day, it seemed, had finally come. The stakes had just been raised yet again, and this time, Cade knew that there could be only one outcome. He would stop the necromancer or die trying. It was that simple. Ever since the day he had returned from the Isle of Sorrows, Cade had kept the feather he believed had come from the wings of the fallen angel Asharael in the safe inside his workshop. The feather had served its purpose. It had led him across the Sea of Lamentations and to his confrontation with the adversary, the thing Asharael had become after centuries of corruption. With the help of Riley and Sergeant Sean Duncan, Cade had been able to destroy the adversary's physical form and send it back to whatever plane of hell it had managed to crawl out of in the first place. Now it seemed that the feather was needed once more. It took Cade almost 2 hours to make the drive from Newport to Willow Grove, during which he had plenty of time to plan out his next move. He assumed his house was being watched. He knew he would have put it under surveillance if he'd been in Riley's shoes, so he couldn't just pull into the driveway and park. Cade had gotten into the habit of walking in the woods behind his home while Gabrielle napped in the afternoon. And during one of those walks, he'd discovered a trail that led him to the shore of a small pond on public conservation land about a quarter mile away from his home. Rather than heading for home, he made his way to that property instead, parking along the street adjoining the road leading to the pond. It was blocked by a narrow chain to prevent the local teenagers from using the place as a makeout spot after dark. He set off on foot and managed to navigate his way through the trees. He stopped at the edge of the tree line at the rear of his property and watched the house and workshop for a time. The lights were off. No one seemed to be there. Cade knew they were there, though. He could feel their presence, an invasion in the otherwise familiar vibe of his home. Under the cover of darkness, he stepped out of the trees and made his way directly over to the rear wall of his workshop. He knew this place intimately, had built every square inch of it with his own hands, so it didn't take any effort at all for him to get to the back door, unlock it with his keys, and slip inside. Cade went straight to the old-fashioned cast-iron floor safe under his workbench. Using the illumination from his phone as a miniature light, he spun the combination dial and opened the lock. He took out the small case in which he stored the feather, checked to be certain it was still inside, and then slipped the case into the inside pocket of his jacket. He closed the safe door, spun the dial to lock it again, and moved back across the room to the door. He got halfway across the backyard.
Someone's in a big hurry.
Cade's curiosity got the better of him. As he slipped back into the cover of the trees, he moved through them in a wide arc until he found a spot from which he could watch the front of the house. He was just in time. Cade watched as the driver's door was thrown open and Riley hopped out and headed for Cade's front door. He didn't make it halfway up the walk before the door opened and another Templar, whom Cade didn't recognize, stepped out to greet him. He'd been right. There were watchers in the house. To his surprise, Riley didn't go in the house, but signaled to the other man to join him, and both of them walked around the side of the house, most likely headed for the workshop in back. Cade glanced at the SUV Riley had arrived in and back again at the house. He'd been out here in the cold and dark long enough. A mischievous smile spread across his face as he headed for the SUV. The two men entered the workshop. Riley flipped on the lights and headed for the library of books that lined one entire wall of the structure. Cade had one of the best occult libraries outside of the Vatican, a result of his unrelenting search for the adversary. Somewhere in one of these books, he was certain he would find a ritual that utilized the two items that Cade had collected in the last several days. He had four people from the tech division on the way with a van full of scanning equipment, and he intended to scan every page and let the computer search through all the data to find what he wanted. It might take a while to find it, but when he did, Riley was certain that it would give him some new insight into where the necromancer might be hiding and how exactly he intended to pull off what Riley suspected he was trying to do. He and Thompson, one of the two men he'd assigned to watch the property for Cade's return, looked at each other and then ran for the door, drawing their weapons as they went. They raced around the side of the house just in time to see Riley's black Suburban race off down the road. For an instant, Riley thought he'd glimpsed Cade at the wheel, but then the vehicle was passed and rapidly accelerating down the road away from them. Thompson's shot actually managed to smash the rear window of the vehicle, but that was all. After that, there were too many trees between them and the vehicle for shooting to do any good.
Come on!
Riley ran for the vehicle that had brought Thompson and his partner, Liddell, here for their shift.
Keys! Keys!
Liddell flipped them over to him underhanded just as they reached the vehicle. Snatching them out of the air, Riley reached for the driver's door and skidded to a halt. His gaze flicked from the front tire to the rear and back again.
Captain?
Riley didn't need to hear what the other man was going to say. He could figure it out for himself. The two tires on his side of the vehicle were flat. He knew without looking that the two on the other side were as well. Cade had outsmarted him again. Cade had disabled the tracking device in the SUV, so he was satisfied he could cover his tracks for the next few hours while he prepared for his confrontation with the necromancer. He pulled the vehicle off on the side of the road.
All right, Logan, let's get this over with.
You have the feather?
Cade was silent.
I see you are tiring of our little game. Don't worry, Commander. It will all be over soon.
Cut the bullshit, Logan, and tell me where to bring this to you.
A locker has been arranged.
Not a fucking chance, asshole. If you want the feather, you can damn well take it from my hand. You get the feather, I get my wife. That was the deal.
All right, Commander. We will do it your way. Warehouse 486, in the Red Hook Container Terminal. 8 p.m.
I'm coming for you, you bastard. You'd best be ready, because I'm coming, and it ends tonight.
The necromancer tossed the phone aside. He wasn't going to need it any longer. It had served its purpose. Williams was on his way. He crossed the room to where two of his acolytes were waiting. It hadn't taken them long to find him after his escape from the Templar holding facility. Like called to like. These two were the most talented out of those who had made their way here to his current sanctuary. He explained what he wanted done and waited to be certain that they understood. When he was confident that they did, he sent them out to the water's edge to carry out his request. If they proved useful when the Knight Commander made his inevitable appearance, He would consider bringing them with him when he moved on from here. He needed to begin reassembling his circle, and these two might just prove to be satisfactory candidates. He would wait and watch and decide their fate later that evening. Logan looked out across the room, watched as three more of his acolytes secured the woman's body to a metal frame, much like the one he'd used during the ritual in Bridgeport. An iron ring went around her forehead, holding her head upright as the uppermost point of the pentacle that her body was forming. Her arms and legs were extended to either side to form the four other points. By making the vessel itself a living, breathing part of the symbol at the very core of the ritual, he hoped to make the passage across the veil easier for the target of his summons. To be helped along, of course, by the sacrifice of her lover and husband.
It's perfection itself.
The Red Hook Container Terminal was a maritime facility located in Brooklyn that serviced container ships and handled bulk cargo destined for New York, New Jersey, and points north into New England. It had six active container cranes operating along more than 2,000 feet of berth, with two major bulk handling yards and almost 500,000 square feet of warehouse space. If the necromancer hadn't specified which warehouse to meet in, it would have taken Cade an entire week to search them all. There was no one at the gate when Cade arrived just before 8 p.m. that evening. He wasn't surprised. He suspected that there were very few living things left inside the terminal at that point, if the necromancer had claimed it for his own. He slowly drove through the gate. Then he parked the truck in the shadows of another building, flipped the hood, and got out. His armor and weapons were in the back seat, so he spent several minutes suiting up. The ceramic body armor went on first, over which he pulled a military-style jumpsuit made from black flame-retardant material. He strapped his pistol to his leg in a quick-draw holster and added four extra magazines to the equipment belt he slung around his waist. A combat knife was secured to the underside of his left wrist, and his sword case went over his back in its usual place. Last but not least, he picked up his HK MP510 submachine gun. With its trademark double magazine, he had 60 rounds of available ammunition before he had to reload the weapon, and he stashed an extra magazine for that in his belt as well. Satisfied that he was armed well enough for bear, Cade had one more task to perform. He opened the released hood and replaced the wire powering the locating device. He waited for the LED indicator to turn red, then nodded once, satisfied, before closing the hood again. Weapons in hand, he set out for his meeting with the necromancer. After learning that Riley had missed another chance at bringing the heretic, as Cade had once been known, in for questioning, the preceptor had taken the case away from him. Command over the hunt for both the necromancer and the heretic passed to Delta, and Riley and his team had been ordered to stand down at the commandery for debriefing at a later time. Riley argued against the move, but was summarily dismissed, his suggestion ignored. But that didn't stop him from continuing the search himself. He sat next to McGreevy in the ops center, paging through scans of some of the material collected from Kay's workshop. She worked at her computer.
That's weird.
What's weird?
The transponder in your SUV? The one Commander Williams, borrowed?
What about it?
Just came back on again.
Riley scrambled out of his chair and moved to her side. It seemed Cade had made another mistake.
Where is it?
Hang on, I'm working on that.
He watched the computer begin narrowing the search, the screen switching from a map of the Eastern Seaboard to one of the states of Connecticut and New York to one of New York City. Moment by moment, the computer was triangulating on the transponder's location and throwing that information up on the screen for them to see. That's when it hit him. Cade was making intentional mistakes. He hadn't accidentally looked at the camera before going into the reliquary. He'd done it for one purpose, just like he'd let Riley see him as he stole the SUV at his house. Just like the transponder in that same SUV suddenly turning itself on again. Cade hadn't needed to steal the SUV at all. They'd found the one he'd taken from the commandery about half a mile away on the other side of the property that backed up to his own. He could have easily made his way back through the woods and driven away without Riley or anyone else being the wiser. Instead, he'd made a spectacle of himself and increased the chances that he might be caught just to get Riley's attention. Cade was leaving a trail for him to follow. He'd just been too blind to see it.
Come on, come on.
A red dot appeared on the map in the middle of the screen.
Where the hell is that?
The Red Hook Container Terminal, Brooklyn.
That's it. That's where they are.
The cavernous interior of the warehouse stretched away before him, illuminated by a series of old arc lights strung across the ceiling, revealing that warehouse 486 was full of shipping containers. They were stacked three rows high and more than a dozen deep, with long aisles between them. Several forklifts were parked in a nearby bay, charging off the building's power supply. Cade chose an aisle at random and began walking forward. The warehouse was eerily similar to the one they had encountered at the start of all this back in Bridgeport, and he knew that the similarity wasn't coincidental. Since the necromancer rarely did anything by chance, he meant for Cade to notice the similarity and was therefore most likely waiting for Cade near the rear of the building. He found the open area at the back of the warehouse, just like the one they'd found in Bridgeport, but it too was empty. He walked to the center of it and turned about, his anger building as he began to suspect that he'd been duped. As if by some prearranged signal, the doors of the shipping containers behind him suddenly flew open and out poured a literal horde of the walking dead. Their flesh, what was left of it, was pasty white and bloated, wrinkled from long immersion in the water. Their eyes, lips, and other softer parts had been eaten away by marine life, and many of them still wore the chains and weights that had been wrapped around their bodies to keep them from floating back to the surface when they'd been clandestinely dumped over the side of a boat or tossed like so much garbage from a nearby bridge. It was as if the sea had suddenly vomited up all those who had been buried in its depths, and as one, the mob focused its attention on Cade.
Whoa, shit.
The bullets did little to stop the mob unless they happened to find a hole in a revenant's skull. Bodies collapsed, sometimes literally disintegrating under the weight of the gravity pulling on long rotting flesh. Those behind them just walked over them in their excitement to reach their prey. The creatures covered three-quarters of the distance between them, and he'd barely made a dent in their oncoming numbers. He began to concentrate his fire in one particular direction, hoping to create an opening he could use, but getting nowhere as more and more of them seemed to pour out of the container cars. Cade reached for his handgun, but a suddenly looming revenant tore it out of his hands before he could bring it to bear. Cade kicked the creature's legs out from underneath it and drew his sword. The size and scope of the horde was too much. They closed in on him, lurching over the bodies of their wounded comrades in their haste to get their hands on him, and soon they were pressing so close on all sides that he no longer had room to swing his sword. The sword was torn from his grasp, but Cade refused to give in. Gabrielle depended on him, and he fought like a demon, his fists and elbows and knees and feet laying waste to the rotting bodies on all sides. For a moment, he thought he might make it. A channel opened between several of the creatures, and he steered the mob in that direction, hoping to catch a break and slip through the ever-closing noose. But then a wild swing from a zombie with only half a face left on its skull caught him on the temple. Cade stumbled, and that one stumble was all it took. The creatures closed in, pummeling him with their fists and feet.
Can't this damn thing go any faster?
Riley was sitting in the co-pilot seat of a Black Hawk helicopter as it whipped over Long Island Sound, headed for the shipping terminal where he was convinced he would find both Cade and the Necromancer. With him in the chopper were the men of the command squad, first squad, and half of second. In the other chopper, less than 200 feet behind them, came the other half of second, as well as third and fourth squads.
You volunteering to get out and push tonight, Captain?
Riley realized he was badgering the pilot. He gave him an apologetic look, but he didn't think the pilot even noticed. The man was too busy dealing with keeping them low enough to avoid the radar of the air traffic controllers at LaGuardia and JFK, but high enough so that they didn't play chicken with any rogue waves rising off the surface of the water.
2 minutes out.
Riley clapped him on the shoulder to show he'd heard. Thankful to have something to do other than worry, Riley keyed the intercom channel that would not only connect him to the men in the chopper with him, but also those in the other bird still hanging off their tail.
2 minutes, Echo, 2 minutes. The LZ might be hot, so we're going in locked and loaded with weapons free. If it looks like a threat, take it down before we regret it. We've dealt with Logan enough to know that he won't give any quarter, so don't take any chances where your life or the lives of your teammates might be in the balance. Unless he proves to be a threat, Commander Williams is to be taken alive and unharmed. Good luck and good hunting.
Cade came back from unconsciousness to find himself tied securely to a pillar in the middle of a warehouse, much like the one he'd fully expected to die in. In front of him, blocking his view of the rest of the room, was the necromancer.
Hello, Cade.
Logan looked better than he did the last time Cade had seen him, back when the sorcerer had been in Templar custody and Gabrielle's ghost had been badgering him to get a message to Cade. But that still didn't make him pretty to look at. The right side of his face was a veritable ruin, his skin scarred from exposure to some kind of extreme heat, the flesh melted together and reformed into some hideous approximation of normalcy. Like Cade's, his eye had not escaped harm, But where Cade's was left intact as a milky white orb, the necromancer's had been destroyed outright, leaving the empty socket to gape like an open wound in his face. A few remaining wisps of long white hair hung from his damaged scalp. The necromancer was dressed in a long hooded robe, tied at the waist with a black sash that had more than a few arcane symbols sewn onto its surface that Cade recognized. It was the kind of robe one wore for ritual workings, and the sight of it worried Cade more than waking to discover himself in the necromancer's custody.
You're just in time for the show. And wouldn't you know, your lovely wife is the guest of honor.
Logan stepped to the side, allowing Cade to see the rest of the room. It was the ritual scene from the Bridgeport warehouse all over again, with two important differences. The first was that the men lying on the floor inside the casting circle were still alive, their arms and legs bound tightly and gags in their mouths. One of Logan's acolytes stood nearby with a naked blade in his hands. The second was that the body of Cade's wife, Gabrielle, had been lashed to the metal framework at the top of the ritual layout. Her unseeing eyes were open, staring out across the space at Cade's. The Night Commander threw himself against his bonds, trying to loosen the ropes that held him enough that he could tear himself free, but to no avail.
I'm gonna tear you limb from limb, you bastard!
Cade strained against his bonds until he was red in the face, and then strained some more, but he didn't gain even a quarter of an inch extra space. Whoever had tied his bonds had known what they were doing. He wasn't going anywhere.
Perhaps you figured it out already. Perhaps not. But I don't want you to misunderstand what is about to happen here. So let me explain, just to be certain.
Logan pointed across the ritual circle at Gabrielle, and this time Cade noted that she was wearing the feather from the adversary's wing in a necklace around her throat.
When you rescued your wife from the beyond, you seem to have forgotten to retrieve her soul in the process, leaving her physical form nothing more than an empty vessel. A healthy vessel, from all appearances, one that would be a sin to waste. After all, there are so many things on the other side of the veil that wish to walk under the light of our sun. So many entities that wish to walk among those they hope to feed upon, to soak in the anger and fear and despair of their victims in the way that only those with physical form can do. I know I don't have to explain all of this to you. You know exactly the kind of being I'm referring to, don't you? You think that you vanquished the adversary, but I am here to assure you that that is not the case. You cannot kill such a being, only inconvenience it for a time. Prevent it from visiting our plane of existence until it has once again managed to gather the power necessary to cast its presence back to this side of the veil. Of course, if one were to invite it to return, to provide the power it needs to make the passage, or even better, provide a vessel for it to reside in.
The idea that something so foul might inhabit the body of his precious wife made Cade temporarily lose his mind.
You're overexcited. I don't want you to miss this. Calm him, Jensen.
An acolyte stepped out of the shadows, approached Cade with a blackjack in his hands. When Cade came back to his senses, he found the ritual already started. Incense burned in braziers somewhere out of sight behind him, filling the room with their cloying scent, while in front of him the necromancer's acolytes were draining the blood from their four victims into large silver bowls. His gaze shot across the room to find Gabrielle, his heart skipping a beat when he saw that for the moment she was still unharmed, still herself, or at least the shell of whom she had once been before all this. The necromancer stood between them in the center of the ritual circle. His head was bowed.
Dana yimfo pohoika, otkin yog mi, chita yikul.
The necromancer stepped slightly to one side, revealing what his body had been hiding from Cade's view. A small wooden table stood there, and resting on the table was the hand, the staff, and a meat cleaver. While his brain was still trying to process that last item, the necromancer reached out and picked it up.
Tis Tatniami! Restog in il of ton me!
Cade felt something in his ear pop, and blood trickled down the side of his face. The necromancer laid his left hand flat upon the tabletop. He brought his right hand, the one holding the cleaver, up over his head.
Og you yawadina!
The necromancer brought the cleaver downward. It slashed through his own wrist, skin, flesh, muscle, and bone, as if it wasn't there, and embedded itself half an inch deep into the wooden surface of the table. The veins in the necromancer's neck stood out like taut wires, and Cade thought Logan was going to scream and collapse to the floor in pain, but the sorcerer held himself together long enough to let go of the cleaver and snatch up the hand. Without hesitation, he shoved the base of that shriveled relic against the bleeding stump of his severed wrist. Cade watched in horror as the flesh of the hand filled out, the skin pushing away from the bones, the blackened, shriveled husk swelling and turning a healthy pink color. The necromancer thrust his hands into the air in a victory stance, and Cade could see that the hand had grafted to the sorcerer's wrist completely, as if he had lived with it since the day he'd been born. Power literally began dripping from its fingers in blackish-green threads of arcane might.
Behold! The Hand of Glory Reborn!
The necromancer snatched up the Staff of Anubis. Logan was surrounded in a sickly black corona of arcane energy that seemed to shift and dance with a mind of its own. Simon Logan pointed the Staff of Anubis at Gabrielle.
Yadrutas! Dixenot me!
Power flashed out from the end of the staff and struck the feather around Gabrielle's neck, enveloping her in an inky ball of energy so thick that she was momentarily lost from sight. Cade watched as Riley and Echo Team came pouring into the warehouse, weapons blazing, tearing into Revenant and Acolyte alike. The necromancer raised the Staff of Anubis over his head, mad with power. Riley took aim. The necromancer flew forward, sending the Staff of Anubis tumbling free from his hand. Now released from the onslaught of all that energy, Gabrielle's body sagged against its bonds in the metal frame on the other side of the room. Her head lolled back and forth on her chest for a moment before going still. Riley rushed over to Cade's side. The battle was winding down around him, the necromancer's acolytes surrendering now that their leader was out of the fray. But Riley's attention was focused now on his friend. He cut through Cade's bonds with his knife. The Night Commander tumbled forward, and only Riley's quick hands kept Cade from collapsing to the floor.
Cade! Cade, where am I?
Gabrielle!
Cade couldn't believe what he was hearing. His grip tightened like a vise on Riley's arm.
Up! Help me up!
Cade looked across the warehouse floor, across the death and destruction, across the blood and the bodies of the dead, and looked into his wife's eyes for the first time in 7 years.
What happened? Why am I in this thing?
She was here, alive, whole.
I love you! I'm here! I'll explain everything! Leave me. Get her down.
Suddenly, Gabrielle's body convulsed. 1 minute she was looking at him with a sense of deep bewilderment, and then her body snapped as if she'd been hit with a bolt of lightning. For one long moment she was still with them, afraid and uncertain of what was going on, and then she blinked. When she opened her eyes a moment later, something had taken up residence there. It stared across the room at Cade, and then it smiled. That smile promised 100 horrible things, each one worse than the last.
Hello, Cade.
No!
Gabrielle flexed her arms and legs, snapping the iron frame, holding her prisoner like a small twig. She landed in a crouch, and as she rose to her feet, great gray and black molted wings sprouted from her back and spread out behind her. The muzzles of Templar weapons swiveled in her direction. She flexed those great wings and launched herself upward. Through the roof and disappearing into the night sky high above. A single black feather drifted down to the floor of the warehouse. Templar Chronicles Book 4, Infernal Games, is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2013, Joseph Nassis. Published by arrangement with Joseph Nassis. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2013, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Unauthorized download and or duplication prohibited. Performed by Terrence Azelford, David Coyne, Thomas Penny, Alexander Strain, Bradley Smith, Nora Ashrati, Mort Shelby, Thomas Keegan, Christopher Graybill, Ken Jackson, Alyssa Wilmoth, Matthew Bassett, Richard Rowan, Eric Messner, Stephen Carpenter, Tim Getman, Michael Glenn, Evan Casey, Colleen Delaney, and Scott McCormick. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Rose Elizabeth Supan. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing by Damian Choppy Chop Richardson. Graphic audio sound design by Nathaniel Perry. Book adapted for graphic audio by Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed Infernal Games, be sure to listen for the continuation of Templar Chronicles, coming soon in graphic audio, as well as Peter V. Brett's The Demon Cycle and Brent Week's The Lightbringer Trilogy, all available in graphic audio at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our titles, as well as free downloads and podcasts. Now, keep listening for exciting previews of other titles in graphic audio.
Blood Valley 6. Support your local deputy.
My deputy, Rusty Irons, was as itchy as a man ever gets. Rusty was waiting for his mail order brides. That's right, brides. Siamese twins, joined at the hip from the Ukraine.
Whoa! We got held up, man.
Quill, tell me, what happened and what got took?
Nothing got took, just the twins.
Were they hostages? Would they be returned for a reward?
Nope, no sign of it.
Who'd want female Siamese twins?
We got a medicine show in town. Professor Zoroaster Zimmer is pushing his elixir. And you know what that means. Nothing safe around here.
We got trouble. George Waller says he's been robbed.
Burgled or robbed?
He says the store's been locked tight at night. But someone's sneaking stuff out when no one's looking. He says arrest all these medicine people.
Sheriff, I'm Hatfield McCoy. This is my wife, Judith. We're members of the Children's Aid Society. Are you familiar with it? The society was formed back east to help the thousands of orphans in the big cities, especially New York. Children who have lost their parents or are simply running free, unsupervised. It is the society's mission to place these children on Western ranches, where they'll become valuable additions to the homes and businesses that adopt them.
And these little people, they got no say in it? Not even if they fear and dread some new parent?
They're minors, sir, under adult supervision. We are their legal guardians.
Trouble, Sheriff. Them two hooligans, they got King and Queen captive and are holding out for $10,000.
Captive? $10,000?
The orphans, little bastards, they worked this out. There's guns all over the ranch, and they collected a bunch. Caught King Bragg and his sister at dawn and her holding them in the big house. Say they want $10,000 and a getaway buggy, and if they don't get the dough, they'll kill King and Queen.
Big Finn, how are you gonna get out of there?
$10,000 in small bills, Sheriff, by sundown. Plus that buggy and fast saddle horses, and you get to be our insurance.
There isn't that much cash in the bank, boy.
That's the deal, Sheriff. Bring the dollars or Queen's gonna croak.
Hey, Sheriff, why don't you just let them kill each other?
Help me, Mr. Mayor. We got people getting killed in there. All right, I'm taking you all in.
What are you charging them with?
Well, let's see. Disturbing the peace, assault and battery, destroying the saloon. I need to look that up. You name it, I'll include it.
The Wild West scoundrels are herewith fined $20 or 2 weeks in our iron cages. Their choice. If they choose to pay, they must leave town before sundown. Now then, the locals who confess to crimes beyond number, crimes exceeding the stars in heaven, must endure a harsher fate. I herewith sentence them all to hang by the neck until dead, 1 week from today.
Bye, Mother.
Oh, that's got the feast. We've been robbed.
We got to have a look. People take our money, let's stand outside of the room. They scale the eyes and the horse right away.
Sheriff, where's my money? What are you going to do?
Now cut it out. I'm a judge here. I'm telling you to quiet down. Now listen to me.
Hang these bastards. String them up.
Alvin, stop this. Before something happens, you'll regret.
Whoa! Kill him!
Available now in graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220, or go to www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series or want the complete series now, check out our long-haul MP3 series sets, conveniently shipped to you on a USB flash drive. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter.